Welcome to Knowing God in the Word. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will be teaching on the purpose of the four Gospels. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. When you are reading a book, have you ever thought about the fact that sometimes it's very important to know the purpose for which a book was written in order to understand it? Sometimes the purpose is obvious. If it's a self-help book, the title will tell you that, or so forth. But sometimes, when it's not so obvious, you have to try to figure out what is the purpose and point of this book. And one interesting example of that is the very famous book, The Wizard of Oz, written by L. Frank Baum. And in recent years, after Baum's death, there was a professor who believed that he had discovered the purpose for which Baum wrote his book. Now, Baum was actually a very political man when he wrote The Wizard of Oz in the year 1900. And this professor thought that he actually wrote this book as a fantasy story that was setting forth his own political and economic commentary on events at the time. Now, Baum, we know, was interested in politics, and he was also very sympathetic to the plight of the Midwestern farmer. And so this professor believed that he was writing The Wizard of Oz about the plight of the Midwestern farmer, represented, of course, by Dorothy, this little farm girl from Kansas. Now, she encounters, after a storm, two wicked witches, one of the East and one of the West. And this professor believed that these witches represented politicians and bankers, both of which he thought didn't really have the best interests of the Midwestern farmer at heart. Dorothy was told by the little people, the Munchkins, the little people, that the way to get home was to follow the yellow brick road. And he believed that Baum was representing the yellow brick road as the gold standard, upon which at the time all our currency was based. If you had a piece of money, supposedly there was gold in the United States Treasury to back up the value of that money, and you could have that currency exchanged for gold anytime you wanted. So the yellow brick road was the gold standard, and it took her to the Emerald City. Emerald being green, he thought represented the currency, the greenbacks. However, when she got to the Emerald City, she found that the wizard, who was supposed to be able to send her home, was actually just a fraud, and he couldn't send her home at all. And ultimately, at the end of the story, she discovered that she had the means of getting home the whole time. Really, at the beginning of her adventure, she had discovered silver shoes. All she had to do was tap the two heels together, and those silver shoes would take her home. And this professor thought those silver shoes represented silver. He thought that Baum thought that we should go from the gold standard to the silver standard. And silver being more volatile than gold, he thought that would result in inflation. And then the loans that many of these Midwestern farmers had would be easier to pay off if the currency was inflating. So this professor thought that was the point of Baum's book. Now, about 40 years later, when MGM went about turning Baum's book into a movie, they weren't really concerned with political things at the time when Baum wrote, but they were excited about showing off their new color technology in film. And silver shoes, they aren't really very impressive in color. I mean, you could practically do them in black and white. So they changed Dorothy's silver shoes into ruby slippers, thereby inadvertently changing the point of the whole thing to be that we should go to the ruby standard, which is, of course, ridiculous. Well, that was this professor's idea, but other people say, no, it was just a children's story, and he's just imagining way too much into it. This was just his own imagination. Well, it was hard to say. Baum definitely was political, and if you read the sequel to The Wizard of Oz, it's kind of a commentary on the women's movement at the time. So it certainly could be that that was what he was trying to get across. But when we come to the Bible, the fact is that we sometimes have to ask the same question. And I think that's particularly true when it comes to the four Gospels. Why were there four Gospels written to tell one story? Because that really is kind of unprecedented in the Scriptures, that you have four repetitions of the same story. Now, the closest we have to that is the story of Hezekiah. and his reign, which is repeated three times in the book of 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and Isaiah. But four times is unprecedented, so why are there four Gospels? And people puzzle over that. What was the purpose of that? Well, some people would say, well, isn't it obvious? Because the story of Christ's life is so important. It's the most important story in Scripture, so God had to tell it four times. Well, I'm not going to argue that the story of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, and who and what he was, is not the most important story in Scripture. I think it is. But at the same time, if you follow this idea out to its logical conclusion, then you have to say that the stories in the Gospels that are repeated the most times are the most important. Now, if we took the story of the feeding of the 5,000, Christ's miraculous feeding of the 5,000, well, that occurs in all four Gospels. And yet, if we took the story of the resurrection of Lazarus, Christ raising Lazarus from the dead, that only occurs in one of the Gospels. So does that mean that the feeding of the 5,000 is four times more important than the resurrection of Lazarus? No, I don't think that that makes sense. But I think that ultimately the reason the book is repeated four different times, and it could partially be importance, but it's also that each book takes a different perspective on Christ's life and has a different purpose. So this morning I want to look into those purposes and discuss the purpose of the four Gospels. Now the first Gospel, of course, is the Gospel of Matthew. And we read in the book of Matthew in chapter 1 and verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now this tells us that it is a book about Jesus Christ. And of course all the Gospels are. But then it says it's about him as the son of David and the son of Abraham. Now what does that mean? Well, we have to realize that to the Hebrews, the word son was very significant. We think of someone's son as just someone's little boy. That your little boy is your son and your little girl is your daughter. That's the way we use it in English. But to the Hebrews, it meant much more than that. You see, their families were not just the people you live with, but their families were in many ways a family business. You not only live together, you work together. And your livelihood and your life depended on your family business. Now, the family business was generally run by the father, the patriarch. He was the CEO, and he was the one who saw to it that everything ran well so that your family would survive, so that you would stay alive. Very important job. Now, what would happen when the father was too old or died and couldn't do that job anymore? Your family might fall into chaos. You didn't want that. So the son was the child who was chosen to be the next patriarch. That was the son. So the son came to mean the one who represents the father and the one who can take the place of the father. And will take the place of the father when he can't be the patriarch anymore. So when this calls Jesus Christ the son of David, it means he's the representative of David. The representative of David's kingly line. See, David was the king of Israel, God's chosen king, the one to whom he gave the throne of Israel forever. And Christ, as David's representative, receives David's throne. Now, Abraham, he was the very first patriarch of the nation of Israel. Now, I realize that Israel was actually his grandson. But at the same time, the entire nation of Israel came out of Abraham. They were his descendants. And so I believe Abraham was the first father, the first patriarch of Israel. And so to be the son of Abraham means to be the representative of the entire nation of Israel. Now, if we would examine the book of Matthew, I believe that we would see that it would fit with Christ as the son of David and the son of Abraham. Because we would see that in the book, Christ is presented as the king of Israel, and therefore the heir to and representative of David's kingly line. And we would see that he is represented as the representative Israelite, the perfect Israelite, and therefore the son of Abraham. Now, in light of the fact that this is the way this book is written, I think that we can see that this book is all about being in Israel. That it's written to Israelites. It's written about Israelites. And it's written about the experience of an Israelite in Israel as he encounters Jesus Christ. Now, the perspective of Matthew, of Christ as king, as the representative of Israel and written to Israelites. I think we can see that as how it's reflected in the birth of Christ story, the Christmas story. That story is represented in Matthew with the lineage of Joseph. He gives Joseph's line, which is ultimately the kingly line, the line from which Christ inherited the throne. You'll see that in Matthew chapter 1, in the beginning verses there, gives Joseph's kingly line. Now, it actually goes back only to Abraham. And that's because Christ, as he's related to Israel, can only relate to Israel from Abraham on. Because, of course, Israel didn't exist before Abraham. Then as it goes through the story of Christ's birth, it gives the story of his birth from Joseph's perspective. Joseph, again, the heir to the throne in the kingly line. And then it has the story of the wise men coming to him as coming to a king. And so in every way, we see that Matthew is about Christ as an Israelite and Christ as a king. Now, next we come to the book of Mark. And I would like to admit up front that Mark is perhaps the most difficult gospel to see the purpose of it. And I'll admit some of the things I read about the purpose of Mark, trying to fit it into the scheme of the four, well, I have trouble seeing the evidence for it in the book. But Mark, when we come to Mark chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." So Mark says that in his book, he is presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son, the representative of God. Now, Christ, I believe, is presented in this book as God's servant or God's slave. In Matthew, it was his relationship to Israel, but here it's his relationship to God as God's servant, as God's slave. And we can see, for example, in the book, how infrequently Jesus is called Lord in this book. He's commonly called Lord in all the books except for Mark, where it's very, very uncommon that he's called Lord. In fact, two occurrences, most significantly, are in chapter 16 after he rises from the dead, after the servant is proven to be the master as well. But for the most part, he's not really called Lord in the book. We can also see he shows a lot of emotion in the book, and it emphasizes his service. Now, what about the audience of the book? Well, this, too, is a lot harder to pin down than it is in the other books. And different people have had different ideas. Matthew, clearly the audience is Israelites. But who are the audience of Mark? Well, some have suggested that the audience are proselytes, Gentiles who had decided to become circumcised and to live like Jews, to join Jews and become Israelites. And they believe that fits with Matthew being to Israelites and Luke being to Gentiles. They think Mark, makes sense, would be written to proselytes. Well, I'll admit that makes sense, but at the same time, I have trouble seeing any evidence of it. Other people have suggested that the perspective of Christ as God's servant would be perfect for the book to have been written to temple servants, those whose job was to serve God in the temple. And that for them to see Christ as God's servant, well, that would fit. That would make sense. But again, I'd have to say, well, that makes sense. I really have trouble finding any evidence of it. It could be. But where's the evidence? It seems like it's just an idea without any evidence to back it up. Now, perhaps the most interesting idea I've heard was suggested, at least when I heard it, by a man named Charles Welch. And he suggested that perhaps Mark was written to Romans. See, Matthew being written to Israelites would be focused very much on the Jewish mindset. Luke was written to Greeks, very much focused on the Greek mindset, and he thought Mark was written to Romans, focused on the Roman mindset. Now, what was the Roman mindset? Well, understand that Romans were a very practical people. They were excellent engineers. Look at the system of aqueducts they built, marvels of engineering. And their system of roads they built around the world. Nothing had been seen like that before. An amazing feat of engineering. And they were also very good and practical at empire building. Their empire lasted longer than any of the empires that had been before it. Now, the Greeks, on the other hand, were very different. They were scientists. They were philosophers. They were good at arts. but they were very bad at practical things. I mean, their empire was a mess. They never were very good at running a world empire. But the Romans were very practical and very much the engineering, the practical type mindset. And we see that Mark goes through stories very quickly, very briefly. It gives you the details and then it moves on. It doesn't spend time philosophizing about things. So it would make sense that it was written to someone with a more Roman, a more practical mindset. Now, it's also been suggested that many words in Mark have a Latin origin more than the other Gospels. Well, I'll admit I haven't been able to personally check that out, so I'd have to take Charles Welch's word for it. But I can't prove that necessarily, but it does seem to me an interesting idea, and perhaps the most likely one, that the audience was meant to be Romans. Now, what about the Christmas story in Mark? How does that reflect the purpose of Mark? Well, basically, it's not told in Mark. And I think that makes sense. Why? Well, because the birth of a slave isn't important. The birth of a king, yes, that's very important. But the birth of a slave, who cares who a slave's parents were? Who cares what a slave's birth was like? Nobody. So the birth story isn't told in Mark. Well, that fits. Then we come to Luke. And Luke tells about his purpose, again, starting in Luke 1:1. When he says, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." Now Luke speaks of those who had taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which had been fulfilled among us. And I believe the way he puts this implies that he's not talking about the other Gospels written before his, those that were written by inspiration, but he's speaking of people who just took it upon themselves. He said, "I know the story of Christ. Wouldn't it be cool if this was written down? I'm going to try to write it down." And without inspiration, they tried to write an account. But Luke says they failed. They didn't really succeed without God's help. But he says, "It seemed good to me because I had a perfect understanding." Now, where did Luke get a perfect understanding? Well, he claims to have heard these things from eyewitnesses. So that helped. But ultimately, I think it was because he had inspiration from God to write. He had a perfect understanding. Now, who is Luke's audience? Well, he says it is the most excellent Theophilus. And Theophilus comes from two words, theos, which means God, and philos comes from phile, which is love, a friendship love, a friendship type affection. So you put those two together, and Theophilus was a God lover, or a God friend. Now that name is a Greek name, and that tells us, I think, that Theophilus was a Greek. And if Matthew was clearly written to the Israelite mindset, to the Israelite way of looking things, well, Luke is clearly written to the Greek way of thinking and the Greek mindset. Now Christ is presented in the book of Luke as the Son of Man. In other words, he is God's perfect man, the perfect representative of humankind. Ultimately, the way perhaps that we should have been if we hadn't fallen into sin back at the beginning under Adam and Eve. Now, we can see how this plays out again in the birth of Christ story, the Christmas story, in that the book of Luke talks a lot about Mary. Not about Joseph, but it's the birth story from Mary's perspective. Luke gives a lot of technical details of the virgin birth, such as would interest the scientists like the Greeks were. He tells about where he was born. He tells about the stable. None of the other Gospels tell about that. But Luke is very interested in the scientific details. Now, Luke doesn't tell about kings coming to visit him, but he tells about shepherds coming to worship him. And of course, Christ didn't just come for kings. He didn't just come for the wealthy and important and influential. He came for all Adam kind. And that's reflected in the fact that Luke tells the story of the shepherds. Then in Luke 3, Luke gives a lineage. But it's not the lineage of Joseph like we got in Matthew. It's the lineage of Mary. Now, he still traces it to Joseph because Joseph becomes the heir of Mary's father, since Mary's father died with just daughters, not sons. And so according to the law, the son-in-law became the heir of the father-in-law. But the lineage in Luke is the lineage of Mary. Now, that makes sense in a book that presents Christ from the human perspective, because that's really his human line, not his kingly line from which he inherited the throne, but his human line from which he inherited his flesh and blood, his human character, his identification with the race of Adam. And that's the bloodline, the technical line, like would interest a Greek. You wouldn't be so interested in where his crown rights came from, but you'd be interested in his human lineage. And so we see that Luke is presenting Christ as the perfect man, God's man, the representative of humankind to God. But then we come to John. And people can't help but notice when they come to John's gospel versus the other three, and the other three are sometimes called the synoptic gospels because they are similar. But John, you have to admit, is very different. Other than a few stories, like I already mentioned, like the feeding of the 5,000, and of course the death, burial, and resurrection, which is told in all four gospels. But other than just a very few stories, John mostly doesn't tell the same stories as the other gospels. He tells very different stories. And John overall is a very different book from Matthew, Mark, or Luke. Now, the higher critics, those who study the Bible and yet criticize it, don't think it's God's word, they argue that the three gospels are so similar because they're all based on a similar source, which many of them call the Q manuscript. Now, if you hear about Q, don't be fooled. There is no historical evidence for Q. Not a shred of Q has ever been found. And no writings about Q have ever been found. Q exists exclusively just in the minds of the higher critics themselves. But they believe blindly in this Q manuscript that no one's ever seen or seen any evidence of. And they believe that this was the basis for the Gospels. Or others argue that Q and Mark were the original compositions, and that Matthew and Luke then combined Q and Mark to get their Gospels. Well, these are the ideas they came up with. But then John, they say, was written much later. And John, because of its exalted presentation of Jesus Christ, they think that John must have been written after many myths and Christian traditions had been solidified and had grown up about Christ. So they don't believe that Jesus was God, so they think the stories of him being God must be myths. Now, a believer in God and in the Scriptures, of course, that can't believe that. But what should we believe about John? Well, I believe that ultimately John's gospel is different because his purpose is different from that of the other gospels. That is, his purpose is to present Christ as God himself. We see that in John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so John's purpose is to present Christ as God. And think about it. If you have three gospels, one presents Christ as a king, one presents Christ as a servant, one presents Christ as a man. But then you have a fourth that presents him as God. Well, which one would you expect to be different? Well, the one that presents him as God, of course. Because there is infinitely more similarity between a king and a slave than there is between even a king and God. God is so much higher than us. So, of course, a book presenting Christ as God is going to be different. Now, we can see that Christ is presented as God in the Christmas story as it's presented in John. Well, again, it doesn't occur there. John doesn't talk about his birth, but he takes us back far before his birth to the beginning and says that Christ was there in the beginning. Well, that's because God has no birth. God has always been. And notice that it doesn't say in the beginning the Word came into being. No, it says in the beginning was the Word. The Word already existed in the beginning. And so he presents not the birth of Christ, but the fact that Christ had no beginning. He was in the beginning because he was God. So each of the four Gospels has a unique perspective on the life of Christ and the person of Christ. And each Gospel has a different audience in mind. Matthew presents Christ as the perfect Israelite and the heir to the throne. Mark gives the Gospel in a practical, no-nonsense way, presenting Christ as a servant. Luke presents Christ as the Son of Man to the reasoning Greeks. And John's gospel was not written merely to record the life of Christ, but rather was written to prove the great premise of the book that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that is the important purpose of the four gospels. We'll close the book at that point, but if you have enjoyed learning about the Scripture from the Knowing God and the Word program and you'd like to learn more, email me and ask to be put on my email mailing list. And I'll send you weekly studies just like this one on various books of the Bible and on Bible topics. Write to me, Nathan, at knowinggodandtheword.org. Feel free to write me with questions as well, or write me through postal mail. Write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. You'll not be solicited for funds in any way when you write, although your donations are always appreciated, so feel free to write. Thank you.
How wonderful it is to recognize the unique perspective each of the four Gospels offers. Each Gospel is a distinct portrayal of Christ, with the book of John standing out as the book that reveals Christ as the Son of God, the representation of God Himself. Realizing this will help bring deeper clarity when we study the book of John. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the purpose of the four Gospels. We hope that you have been edified and encouraged by this program, and that you can join us on our next program when Nathan will begin his teaching series on the book of John. When and for what purpose was the Gospel of John written? For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.